This is Space Kate at the International Space University Space Studies Summer Program. And, well, we're sitting out in the warm air outside the canteen, and there's a bunch of, I think they're Navy scouts or Navy cadets that are marching. So if you hear that in the distance, don't be alarmed. We've already had the email saying the guns aren't real, so we should be okay. But more importantly, sitting with me is Professor Scott Hubbard, who is a professor at Stanford University and, well, according to everything I've read, a Mars SAR. Also previous director of Ames. Is there anything you haven't done?
Oh, I've been involved in all sorts of research, development, science, and exploration for 35 years. So I've covered a lot of territory.
How do you get the title Mars SAR?
Actually, that was awarded to me by a member of the media when I got to Washington, D.C. in the spring of 2000 to reconstruct the Mars program. A senior writer for Space News, wrote an article about what I was supposed to do, and he dubbed me the Mars Czar, and it stuck. So you can't award nicknames to yourself. They come from somewhere else.
And we were listening to some of the things you were talking about yesterday on the panel, and I was very interested to hear you say this idea of follow the water. How important is that when we're thinking about looking for life in the universe?
We've learned a great deal since the missions of 30 or 40 years ago. It's extremely difficult to actually directly detect life, a living organism or even a dead organism. What we learned from Viking, which was the mission to Mars in the mid-70s, is that you need to look for habitable environments, a place where life would find it comfortable if it did appear. And a key element to all life as we know it on Earth is liquid water. And so out of that change of focus from direct detection of life to habitable environments came the idea of follow the water, because if the water has been there, then life could have appeared.
And we have detected traces of water on Mars. How do you actually go about doing that? I mean, I'm going to ask the stupid question so that other people don't have to, but Mars is a long way away. Nobody's been up there. No person has been up there. How do we know there's actually water?
Well, it started out, of course, with measurements from Earth where it looked like maybe there were ice caps. But it wasn't until we really had close-up investigation that we could confirm that. The Mars Global Surveyor saw some evidence of recent water on Mars in the sense of things that look like there had been a flash flood. But part of the serious data came with Mars Odyssey, which was launched in 2001, named after Arthur C. Clarke's famous book. And it detected literally billions of tons of water ice, particularly at the North Pole of Mars. And so then a few years later was sent the Phoenix mission. The Phoenix mission actually landed at that spot, and the first thing that it saw under the lander legs was this big white plate of water ice, and that was tested. It grabbed up samples, put it in the onboard chemistry set, let's call it, and it says, yes, this is water, or water ice. Now, of course, the surface of Mars is very cold, and all of the top meter, 3 feet or so, of the water would be in the form of ice. But we now see things that look like river valleys, look like ancient crater beds. We see minerals associated with water. We've found tons and tons of water ice. So I think that the science community has drawn the inescapable conclusion that Mars, in its past, had abundant flowing water on the surface, and there still could be liquid water under the surface somewhere.
There's a wonderful exhibit in Toulouse at the Space Center there, where they have all like models of all of the different rovers all lined up, so you can really sort of see the evolution from this tiny little box up through to Curiosity, which is actually kind of monstrously big when you see it.
Yes.
Why does it need so big and to be so big, and what is it that you're hoping that Curiosity will find that previous Mars rovers were unable to detect?
The evolution of the Mars rovers was quite deliberate and strategic. I proposed what became the Mars Pathfinder mission with the little sort of toaster oven sized rover, which was really a technology demonstration. And I proposed that idea in 1990. And of course it landed on Mars in 1997. Then when I was asked to be the Mars Czar, it was clear that we needed to continue mobility. but at a larger scale where you could actually do serious scientific investigations. I mean, the Pathfinder rover Sojourner was a terrific demonstration and did some limited science, but it wasn't big enough. So we settled on something that would fit inside the envelope, and by envelope I mean the parachute entry, descent, landing specification of Pathfinder, but would be a full-blown mobile laboratory. And that set the size of the two rovers, Spirit and Opportunity, about 150 kilograms, 300 pounds, with a great science set. Then as we were planning the future program and looking at the orbiter and lander opportunities, we said, because Mars has 80 different units, geologic units on it, we have to be able ultimately to make a traverse that's not just a kilometer or so, which was the success criteria for Spirit and Opportunity, but tens of kilometers. Well, once you say tens of kilometers, that means you've got to be robust, more robust. You need more power, and you, of course, want to take more instruments with you. And so that set then the next generation of rover, which is Curiosity. Future missions may well be somewhere between these two. That remains to be seen. But that growth was in order to get more science and go further.
Well, Curiosity will be landing, hopefully, on Mars in just less than 2 months. And we saw a kind of video simulation of the very complex landing mechanism. I'm kind of watching it and thinking, how on earth is this going to work? Are you confident that it's going to land successfully?
I'm as confident as you can be when you're dealing with Mars. I mean, the overall world record, the odds of getting successfully to Mars is not terrific. There have only been one out of three missions over the last 50 years that have been fully successful. But more recently, this last decade, we've had tremendous success. But it hasn't been accidental. It's been because a very robust test program, really good systems engineering, I mean, paying attention to how the pieces fit together, great testing and so forth. So given that Mars is hard to get to and to land safely, within that disclaimer, I think they've tested this procedure extremely well. The reason we have what's called the Sky Crane, which looks sort of like a rocket-powered helicopter, is
pretty amazing.
It really is. It's truly amazing. But when I proposed in 1990 the airbag landing, that looked kind of crazy then, mm-hmm. and it turned out to be very robust. It worked. It worked three times. But it didn't scale. And if you try to have a larger rover that goes further than Spirit and Opportunity, the airbag technique becomes so heavy that you can't afford the payload. And then if you look at landing on a pallet, landing on some kind of surface that's part of your protective cocoon, driving off of it becomes a real trick. I mean, it was not trivial to drive Spirit and Opportunity off of their landing system, which included the airbags. I mean, what if you'd gotten tangled up? What if they hadn't deployed properly and so forth and so on? Landing right on your legs is fine for a static lander like Viking or Phoenix, but we want mobility. And it turned out, after you go through all of the trades of the pluses and minuses, that landing on the wheels made the most sense. Well, now how do you land on the wheels? Well, you know, I guess you kind of lower yourself on the wheels, and out of that grew the idea of the Sky Crane. And so it was a logical progression, even if it looks a little bit odd. But the engineers at JPL and the other centers involved, Langley and Ames, plus other companies, they've really done a lot of testing. So I have pretty high confidence that it'll work. But you know, everybody will have their fingers crossed for the.
Yeah, I can imagine there'll be a few people holding their breath, just waiting for that to touch down. So if we just briefly look at the future, I mean, a lot of people see Mars as the next step for humans. So there's been quite a lot of conversation about how and when we might be able to send humans to Mars. And I just wanted to ask, what's your opinion on the different idea of You know, when we sent people to the moon, it was to send them within this decade to the moon and bring them safely back home. Mm-hmm. Do you think that we will be bringing people back from Mars? And how important do you think that will be in sort of a first mission? Or will it be a one-way trip?
Well, if the United States government, which I have, you know, 20 years of experience with or longer, is involved, it will be a two-way trip. It will be a round trip. If you remember Kennedy's speech that you referred to, it was to, by the end of the decade, send man to the moon and return him safely. And so I can't see the government accepting a one-way trip. Now, private entrepreneurs, that's a whole different story. And people routinely go to scale Everest on a private expedition and they lose their life. So I wouldn't want to think what entrepreneurs might do, but I think the government would be committed to sending them there and returning them. And that round trip, of course, would consume about 3 years, and there are still a lot of biomedical questions to be answered.
If the private industry doesn't have that quite so many constraints, if it does decide, for example, Elon Musk has said he'd like to retire on Mars, do you think that means that private industry might actually get there before NASA or any of the international governmental space agencies?
Well, I've known Elon Musk for a long time. I've known him since before he founded SpaceX, frankly. And I wouldn't bet against the guy because he's very determined and he's been very successful. But I will say, having been involved in space missions for a long time, that Earth orbit, let's say, is on a scale of 1 to 10, degree of difficulty 4. Going to Mars and landing safely is degree of difficulty on 1 to 10, 11. It is exceedingly hard to do because you not only have to leave the Earth's pull of gravity and get on a safe trajectory to Mars, then you have to come through the atmosphere and land in a very thin atmosphere safely, and then you have to survive. So Elon and SpaceX have demonstrated the first private capability to return to Earth, which uses some techniques that are similar, but getting the 150 million miles or so to Mars is another big degree of difficulty. And I wish him well. I hope that commercial space and low Earth orbit flourishes. I think it's important. And I think that, a government-private partnership, or more likely maybe an international partnership, will be how we get to Mars.
Okay. Well, thank you ever so much for taking a moment to talk to me, and I shall let you get on and get some lunch. Thank you.
Thank you very much.